Greetings, this is Will Emmons, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is Bill Spence, active in the Carbondale community, and in an earlier time, a geophysicist, seismologist for the United States Geological Survey. In 1962, he began monitoring the movement of the Earth from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Bill.
It's good to be here, Will, and I look forward to our conversation.
Well, me too. And the Earth is very active, and so although the movements of the crust are small, sometimes large shifts become of great interest to human beings.
There's a set of plates that surround the entire Earth. One could think of the Earth as a group of a half dozen or so lithospheric plates that are like curved shells that move relative to each other. And of course, the accommodation between these movements isn't perfect, so there are a number of smaller, we call them microplates. And along the boundaries of these plates where they come in contact is where friction builds up because the plates resist motion at their edges. And when the strength of that resistance is overcome, you get an earthquake. And these earthquakes can be situations, for example, continental plate, such as the Indian subcontinent, is impacting the Asian subcontinent. So that gives rise to the Himalayas, plus a lot of earthquakes. That's an example of a continental-continental collision.
Right.
Those are the highest mountains in the world, of course. A very active plate boundary is that in South America, where we have the Nazca Plate, which is an oceanic plate, moving eastward and colliding with the South American plate, which is moving more slowly to the west. And that collision not only produces the Andes chain of mountains and volcanoes, but many earthquakes at that convergence zone. And the oceanic plate being more dense than the continental plate, it tends to slide under the continental plate. And in fact, that plate returns into the Earth's mantle, going down to a depth of maybe 700 kilometers.
Wow.
So there could be earthquakes all along that zone.
So you monitored mostly earthquakes, but you also paid attention to volcanoes.
Just in a peripheral way, well, they are both due to plate tectonics type phenomena, but the earthquakes are due to the resistance between plate motions. The volcanoes are caused by a subducting plate when it hits a depth of about 100 kilometers in the Earth.
And a subducting plate is one going underneath another one.
Yes, correct. And at that point, the conditions of temperature, pressure, plus the material that was entrained in the top of the subducting plate forms a volatile mix of partially melted rock, which when it melts, it expands. And its density then is such that it tends to ascend to the surface, and it shows itself in volcanoes. And some volcanic zones are much more active than others,
right.
The most active one being the Sunda Arc in Indonesia,
right,
where you have Krakatoa and Tambora and many very active large volcanoes.
And in your early days, you monitored events other than earthquakes and volcanoes.
Well, the research was driven in the early days by where the money was. At that time, the money was in nuclear detection.
Often the case.
Yeah. So we monitored sites in Russia and off the coast of Western Russia, and also got into problems like, can you set off two nuclear explosions that have a time difference between them of maybe a second, so they mask each other and people don't know what you did. So we were considering all kinds of possibilities in the nuclear detection program.
I'm sure. And then you mentioned already plate tectonics, but at first that wasn't even part of the understanding of the Earth when you began, and it became an important part, a very important part in your career as time progressed.
Yeah, that's right. Well, when I began in 1962, we knew earthquakes were associated with faults, but we didn't know what stresses drove the motions on the faults. For example, the big change was in 1964 with a earthquake near Anchorage, Alaska, a 9.2 magnitude.
I remember that one.
Yeah. I remember talking with a friend of mine in Denver, Hugh Matheson, who was driving outside of Anchorage at the time of the earthquake, And he stopped his car because he thought he had a flat tire. But the road, the waves from the earthquake were undulating the road.
Right.
So he thought all those bumps were actually a flat.
And then with the understanding of plate tectonics, you've shared an image, and you gave me an earlier one that the Earth is a sphere covered with plates in a way like a jigsaw puzzle that doesn't quite fit, so that when pieces try and go underneath one another, that creates the friction, and it gets hung up and then eventually comes out as the earthquakes we've talked about.
Right. For example, getting back to the 1964 Alaska earthquake, after a lot of research by a lot of pretty clever people, it wasn't until 1968 that we realized what was really going on. And this earthquake was really related to the larger scale motion of the Pacific plate hitting the Aleutian Arc and of course, subducting under the North American plate, which is still Alaska up there. So then we had a handle on, in fact, it revolutionized geology and geophysical thinking, and then we were off and running because we had the unifying paradigm of how the mobile Earth works.
The mobile Earth, yeah, that's a good phrase. You already said that that upper mantle contains hot material that wants to find a way out, and that creates both the movement of earthquakes and the movement of the plates and volcanoes as well.
The mid-oceanic ridge system is where new plate is generated. Material upwells, buoyant rock material, basalt actually, upwells from the Earth's mantle, and when it hits the surface, it sort of divides equally one way and the other, and there's a spreading center. There's 60,000 miles of spreading centers around the whole Earth. The entire Mid-Atlantic Ridge goes around, it splits and goes around both the tips of South Africa and South America and hooks up with continuous spreading centers. And some of these spreading centers are so active that there are actually islands there. For example, Iceland is on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. It's right on the spreading center. And if you go to Iceland, you can, if you see Surtsey or one of those active volcanic eruptions, you're witnessing this very process.
Wow. But you said the movement of the plates is generally slow. And I think it would be of interest if you'd tell us what the slip rate is of the San Andreas Fault.
Okay, sure. The San Andreas Fault system, it's not a singular plane on which slip is occurring, but a whole set of parallel faults. And they're all capable of being loaded with stresses that can produce significant earthquakes. The last big earthquake in Southern California was in 1857, the Fort Tejon earthquake, magnitude 7.8. The last big earthquake in Northern California was the famous San Francisco earthquake and fire, magnitude around 7.7. Geologists have trenched along these earthquake faults and very meticulously dated the material they find in there in zones of disturbance, and they can carbon date them. And they've gone back like 1,200 years, and they've concluded that the repeat time for earthquakes in both those sections of the San Andreas is about 130 years. So if you add 130 to 1857, you get 1987. So where's the next earthquake? In Southern California, people are waiting for it, and they're very active in earthquake drills. And
they just had a big earthquake drill.
They just did, about 10 days ago.
Right.
People learned to get under strong objects like desks or to stand in the frames of doors or evacuate the building if you have time. They're very conscious of that risk there. Our risk here is more highways, I suppose, snow, animals, and landslides.
You had mentioned to me earlier, I thought that the slip rate for the San Andreas Fault was 2.2 inches per year.
It is. That's a long-term average. When a big earthquake occurs, the slip might actually be, well, we seismologists talk metric, I'm sorry. But the big earthquake in 1906 in San Francisco was about a slip of about 6 or 7 feet. And you can go places and see where roads are offset and the line runs right through an orchard or whatever. And so
So an earthquake occurs when that slow, gradual slip hangs up somewhere and then the tension breaks loose.
The 2.2 is a number that you think of in terms of geologic time.
Right.
But in fact, the real motion is very jerky. It hangs up and then goes in a big jump.
You use the phrase, anything can happen.
That's right. We can't predict the earthquakes. Earthquake prediction was a hot topic in the late 60s and into the 70s. Chinese actually predicted an earthquake using anomalous animal behavior in 1975. The Haicheng earthquake was a stimulus for the Chinese organizing earthquake alert groups in all farming communities, but that was a singular and unusual prediction. Four years later, the Tancheng earthquake in 1979 in China killed around 250,000 people. China has huge life losses from earthquakes. For example, one in the year 1556 killed around 850,000 people.
My goodness.
Yeah, because of poor construction, mostly.
And there was one case where there seemed to be a successful prediction based on animal behavior.
Well, this was the Haicheng earthquake of 1975 in China.
Yeah.
But through a lot of funding and research, it turned out that was a fairly singular success. There are many things that should precede stress going critical in an earthquake zone, and it seems as though earthquake prediction could be a possibility. But it turns out that it really isn't possible. Because what's happening is like 15 kilometers below the surface of the Earth, and you can't directly measure what's going on. Everything's inferred from surface measurements, and you might see a cluster of earthquakes, and they might be foreshocks, but you really don't know that they're foreshocks until you get a main shock. Usually it's just a little cluster of earthquakes, and that's it. And there are many other geophysical indicators that have been looked at, but in fact, there's nothing that consistently will lead you to saying this is a prediction and alerting the public, because if you cry wolf too many times, they're going to ignore you. There's nothing that's reliable enough. So the way it goes is earthquake forecasting. We statistically assess the rate of occurrence in earthquake zones and go back and find historical records, and we see that chances of, say, a magnitude 7 occurring within the next 30 years. And things are framed in that sort of way for engineers to help them develop proper building strengths or overpass criteria or whatever.
And there was a famous case that you studied in some detail where a projection was made that failed to be true.
Yeah. That was a case in New Madrid, Missouri, in the Midwest. And, of course, there's not a plate boundary there today. The New Madrid earthquake fault is well known and has small earthquakes, but in 1811 and 1812...
There's a very big one.
In a two-month period, there were three, like magnitude 8 earthquakes in that zone.
Yeah.
If that sort of thing were to occur today, Memphis and St. Louis would be clobbered big time, plus all the surrounding communities. The New Madrid earthquake of December 12th, 1811, rang church bells in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But at any rate, there was a sort of business consultant fellow. His name was Ivan Browning, Dr. Ivan Browning. And he somehow thought that looking at tidal loading of the moon on that zone could peak at certain times if the moon were closer than normal in its orbit to the Earth. And he thought that small increase in gravity loading could trigger an earthquake if the zone was near critical. But in fact, that's not how it works. And he was dead wrong, but he was fairly insistent. People would say, what are the chances of this happening, Dr. Browning? You say, oh, 50-50. He really didn't know. And it just caused tremendous concern and unrest in the Midwest for about a year.
The fear started to run.
Fear. The newspaper accounts of that whole incident are amazing reading, because one thing built on the other, and people were really believing this was going to occur. In fact, I was in New Madrid, Missouri, on the day, December 3rd, 1990, when this earthquake was supposed to occur.
You went there to be present.
Well, I was traveling incognito. My agency didn't want to validate that a USGS scientist was
going to give it credibility.
Was there, but I saw Governor Ashcroft, and you know, all the political bigwigs were there, and you could feel in the air the expectation that this is going to happen. And of course, I was thinking this is total hogwash, and walking around taking pictures, trying to enjoy the scene, but there's nothing to be done. It had a life of its own, this prediction.
But the day passed uneventfully.
Totally, yeah.
But there is a probability that there may be some kind of a big event in the Northwest at some time in the Cascadia area.
This is an example of a microplate. It's the Juan de Fuca plate. It's north of Cape Mendocino and goes northward to mid-Vancouver. It is moving eastward. The North American plate's moving sort of southwestward. And so there's a subduction zone there. In the subduction of the Juan de Fuca plate, there leads to the Cascade line of volcanoes. That's due to the plate convergence process. But in the year 1700, January 26th, as we now know, there was a magnitude 8.5 to 9 earthquake in Cascadia. And of course, Native Americans lived there, but we have no written record of that earthquake, but it was through a remarkable bit of geologic sleuthing, plus a fortuitous measurement of the tsunami from that earthquake in Japan that allowed us to reconstruct this whole scenario and eliminate other possibilities of the tsunami in Japan having come from South America or the Aleutians. Anyway, the geologic evidence now is very robust. This earthquake occurred in Cascadia. So, of course, the big question is, what is the recurrence period for an earthquake of this type and size in Cascadia? And the subject of a lot of research, and we don't know the answer yet, but it's happened before. It'll happen again.
Yeah, and that event triggered a tsunami that was recorded in Japan in 1700.
Yeah. That's how we know the actual date. We know the time. It was 9 in the evening of January 26th in Cascadia.
You touched on this a little bit before. Are there some animals that can detect earthquakes?
Well, I think that some animals can respond to earthquakes after they've occurred better than humans. For example, the 9.2 earthquake that occurred in western Indonesia a few years ago that caused the big tsunami that killed a great many people.
Right.
There are many stories of elephants getting highly restless and running from their areas prior to the tsunami. When an earthquake occurs, if it's of that size, it releases a whole spectrum of energy. What I mean is the wavelength of some of the earthquake energy you can hear yourself. Some of the energy is of such a long wavelength that it's sub-audible. Humans can't hear it, but elephants communicate with very low-frequency sounds, and the elephants were responding to this energy, this acoustical energy from that earthquake, and they became unruly.
They could hear things we couldn't hear.
Yeah, sure.
And your seismographic equipment, it records acoustic waves
travel
through the earth.
Seismographs now are broadband digital instruments that record the whole works. So we can use this total information now to very accurately estimate the magnitude of an earthquake. By the way, a magnitude is a logarithmic measurement of base 35 or so. That is, a magnitude 7 is 35 times more energetic than a 6. And magnitude 8 is 35 times more energetic than a 7, so 35 times 35, and you get over 1,000 times more energy in a magnitude 8 than a magnitude 6.
Hmm. And there's some oral history that can be helpful in guiding human behavior in situations where earthquakes might occur. I'm familiar with places where people live by the coast, and then when they watch the bay go dry, everybody ran for high ground because they knew the water was going to suck out and then come back in a big wave.
That's right. Tsunamis, which are generated by usually a dislocation in the seafloor, will travel across the open ocean at 500 or 600 miles an hour. And then when they hit a shallower coastline, the energy that's carried beneath the surface of the water causes the energy to be concentrated upwards and push up. The particle motion of that energy is retrograde elliptical, we call it. But what that means is, because it's retrograde, is that when a tsunami is approaching a distant coastline, that the water withdraws from that coastline and just leaves the ocean floor bare. And there are a lot of anecdotes of people who don't have that oral history that run down to harvest floundering fish and so on.
Or go look for my old sunglasses I dropped last spring.
Could be.
Serious mistake to do that. Though.
Very serious mistake, because the return of that displaced water will be horrendous. And tsunamis generally are in wave trains. There might be a series of several of these waves. So they're spaced like an hour and a half, 2 hours, very long period phenomena.
Well, it was amazing for me to Google earthquake activity and just see this whole Pacific ring of fire and activity that's going on at a level I hadn't realized.
The Circumpacific Basin is extremely active seismically. The Pacific Plate is moving to the northwest. It is causing great earthquakes in the Aleutian Arc, Kamchatka, the Kuriles, Japan, on down. Then, of course, we did talk about South America. There's a lot of activity in Central America and Mexico, although there the maximum earthquakes are like 7.5 magnitude, characteristically smaller earthquakes. Mm-hmm. Colorado had a big earthquake in 1882, magnitude 6.5. That was just west of Fort Collins. 1882 earthquake was not measured by a seismograph. Seismographs weren't invented till 1896 by a Count Galitzin in Russia. At any rate, in 1882, we had to rely on how strongly the earthquake caused shaking locally. So we have had a map. We got all the anecdotal evidence of reports of shaking. It happened to be on election eve in 1882.
That was an ominous morning, wasn't it?
People thought there would be a change of regime, yeah. at any rate, must have been a midterm election. At any rate, using the Rocky Flats, the famous Rocky Flats earthquakes of the mid to late 60s outside of Denver, and knowing degree of shaking from those earthquakes and what magnitude they had, we could, using graphs, reconstruct the magnitude of that 1882 earthquake. Now, that's a very rare event for Colorado. Most earthquakes in Colorado are 2.5 magnitude.
So our risk is pretty low, but is there a correlation at all where oil and gas extraction is active with increased earthquake activity?
I don't think in any way that is significant. Remember that logarithmic discussion we just had? When you extract oil and gas, you might be triggering small earthquakes like magnitude 2, but they're insignificant in terms of that triggering, say, a magnitude 6, which you need to be damage-causing.
And the earthquakes that were happening north of Denver at the Arsenal when they had those deep wells and were pumping things we don't talk about into the earth, they caused a lot of minor earthquakes.
They did, and there were earthquake swarms there. But the people doing the pumping denied any relationship, but a couple of geophysicists at the School of Mines, plus a consulting geologist on the outside, put it all together, and it was very exciting to our profession because we thought, gee, if we can do that, we can maybe unload the San Andreas in a reasonable way or can predict earthquakes. But none of that panned out. The largest earthquakes from the Denver Arsenal series were like magnitude 5.2 and 5.3 in 1967.
So knowing all this and having spent your career studying earthquakes, is there anything you do to be prepared for an earthquake?
It's one reason I live in Carbondale. There's not a lot of risk from earthquakes in Colorado, really.
That's the best thing to do to be prepared.
Yeah, don't live in an earthquake. Don't live in earthquake country.
Okay.
Is there more?
No, that's wonderful. Thanks, Bill.
Sure. Okay. Well.
Great fun.
Yeah.
This is Will Evans. I've been speaking with Bill Spence. You're listening to KDNK.
As you heard, Colorado is at low risk for damaging earthquakes. And we live in a changing world. There are benefits to being prepared for unexpected events and transitions. Two helpful sources about home emergency preparedness are available from the Colorado Department of Health. You can call them at 303-642-2777. 1-800-273-6363 and request the pamphlet, Are You Ready? Or you can go to their website, whatifcolorado.com, and gather the information there. Probably not for an earthquake, but are you ready for turbulence blowing in the winds of change? How would you fare in a long snowstorm that closed the roads for a week or two, took out the power, or left the shelves at City Market empty? Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Jim Hightower.
We are here.